Yeah, before I start, I wanted to say something about how me and Ben came to be doing this. So about a year ago, myself and Ben went hill walking, and we had our second attempt on Ben Ledi, which is the hill just outside Callander. The first attempt, we were beaten back by the elements, but last spring we had a second attempt on a glorious spring day. So it was a lovely walk and lovely sharing the walk with Ben. And as we were coming down, we entered the forest, and there was just a eruption really of birdsong. Summer migrants had just arrived and they seemed really happy, so there was lots of wobbling and song. And kind of spontaneously, Ben broke into a chant, and it was one of the Sukhavati Sutras. And all the way down through the forest, Ben had memorized this and he was just chanting it as we went through the forest. And it just seemed like a spontaneous eruption inspired by that beautiful spring day and all the birds singing. Because, of course, in Sukhavati, in the pure land of Amitabha, the birds sing the Dharma, the melodies of the Dharma. So, going forward, a good few months, Pasadena asked me to do something on the rainy season retreat. And my initial response whenever I get asked these things is to say no. I've become very good at it over the years. But I didn't say no. I just thought I'd think about it. So I decided just to sit with it for a day. Just previously, I just had me and Ben had our Kalyana Mitra ceremony, and I thought, well, Ben's come into my world, which is mountains, and come walking with me, so why don't I go into his world, which is the world of the sutras, the Mahayana sutras, and why don't we do something together? So my no was turning into a maybe, and I had a talk with Ben and it turned into a yes. So probably much to Pasadena's surprise. I agreed that we would come and do something. And it's been great actually, working on Ben and thinking about what we're going to do. So Ben's been the DJ, he is the Sukhavati DJ, music conducive to the Pure Land, from various sources. He was up late last night with all these wonderful sounds, And last week, the Dana Kusha community and Ben have been creating the jewel trees, for those of you who are familiar with Sukhavati's Pure Land, you'll know that there's jewel trees. If you're not, there's jewel trees. So Sukhavati it's got various features. It's flat, so it gets a slight. Where's the mountains? I'd love to see some mountains. But in those days, I think mountains were seen as hostile places, where you couldn't grow anything and you couldn't live. They're not as mountains are viewed these days. My Pure Land would definitely grow some mountains. I couldn't have a flat Pure Land. And it's got these jewel trees, all made of the seven precious substances. So we've got six of them here. Didn't have quite time to do the seventh. So Ben will put me right if I got this wrong, but we've got gold, silver, lapis lazuli, quartz, coral or ruby and emerald. We're missing sapphire. So these are the jewel trees which are in Sukhavati. And the jewel trees are they're huge. Yeah, they're several yojanas high. Yeah. So a yojana is apparently the length that a fully equipped army can move in a day. An interesting image, that. Apparently it was about 9 miles. You've got to get the elephants moving and all laden up with whatever they went to war with in those days. Yeah. So that's a yojana. So these jewel trees are huge. Yeah. This is starting to say something about the world that we're moving into with the cavity. So yeah, this is our jewel trees. And also we've brought a Amitabha. So the Amitabha was shipped up from a barn in Devon. I go to Nepal quite regularly and buy statues, but I had to go to the opposition for this. So Dhiramati is Buddhist Images Incorporated. Yes, he has anything I don't have in Dhanakosha's storeroom, Dhiramati will have. So I phoned Dhiramati and he kindly sent me up this large Amitabha. And also, Ben has created a sun disk. Yeah? And in the visualization of Sukhavati, the first thing you visualize is the sun. So we're going to have a go at this later on today, this afternoon. Yeah? And it's a way of transferring or transitioning between our world and the world of Sukhavati. Through the image of the sun, the setting sun. So there are three Sukhavati sutras. There's the shorter sutra on the abundance of wonderful qualities which adorn Sukhavati, and Ben's going to be reading that this afternoon, or reciting it this afternoon. So it's the first thing we'll do this afternoon. And then there's the longer sutra on the abundance of wonderful qualities which adorn Sukhavati. And we're reading bits of that tomorrow, again in the afternoon session. And then there's the sutra on the visualization of the Buddha Amitabha, which is the third Sukhavati sutra. And I'm going to be referring to that in the talk this morning. It's kind of what's inspired this talk, really, is this third Sukhavati Sutra. So I'll just say something about Mahayana Sutras. I guess most of you are familiar with Mahayana Sutras. But if you're not, they're very different in feel and flavour from the Theravada Sutras. The sutras that deal with the Buddha and his teaching. There you'll generally find the Buddha teaching in some place that Google Maps could find. If they had such devices then, Google Maps would be able to find where he was teaching. Maybe on the edge of a village, edge of a city, forest grove. And he'd be maybe teaching one person, a wanderer, a Brahmin that he met, or maybe be teaching a group of disciples. And sometimes these disciples would number a few hundred, and sometimes there would be non-human beings there as well. When you get to Mahayana Sutras, Google Maps would be struggling. It would be hard to pinpoint exactly where they were. And also it'd be hard to count the number of beings there. The White Lotus Sutra, within a couple of pages, the caste has got over 100,000, and that's just the start. Yeah, it's just getting going. Yeah. In the Sukhavati Sutras, they're a bit more modest. It starts off with about 32,000 plus a few arahants, yeah, mainly 32,000 bodhisattvas, a few arahants. And then the gods and other beings come in, and the bodhisattvas and the world systems start to come in, and you've got infinite number of beings, yeah, and galaxy upon galaxy upon galaxy, world system moving into world system. I remember when I first came across the Mahayana Sutras, I just thought, well, how can I relate to this? It just seems a bit removed from my everyday reality. I had the experiences of altered states of consciousness through what I did before I was a Buddhist. So that gave me, I think, some sense of what they were talking about in the Mahayana Sutras. Yeah, but if I hadn't had that experience, yeah, then I might have struggled to, you know, get the Mahayana Sutras. I was going to quote something from Ridzing Shikpo, and his book, Introducing Mahayana Sutras. And he says, the Mahayana Sutras introduce us to a sense of our being intimately connected with the vastness of the universe in terms of both space and time. The Mahayana Sutras introduce us to a sense of our being intimately connected with the vastness of the universe in terms of both space and time. Yeah. So that's what they're doing. I just thought I'd read something from the larger Sukhavati Sutra, just to give something of the flavour. So the Buddha, as in Theravada Sutras, is talking to Ananda, and he's going through describing Sukhavati. Ananda, there are also many different kinds of rivers that run through that world system, Sukhavati. There are great rivers, a yojana across. There are great rivers as much as 20, 30, 40 or 50 yojanas across, and 12 yojanas deep. All of these rivers flow smoothly with sweet-smelling, fragrant waters. As these waters flow forth, they carry within them great masses of flowers encrusted with different kinds of precious substances, and they fill the air with delightful, melodic sounds. Ananda, imagine that there were a musical instrument composed of countless of hundreds of thousands of parts, and that this musical instrument was played with great skill and accompanied by heavenly choirs, such that it created a sound that soothed the mind. That is what the sound of these great rivers is like. It is profound, ungraspable, unfathomable, and pure. It is a delight to the ear, and it touches the heart. It is enchanting, delightful, and it soothes the mind. It is agreeable and appealing to listen to. Murmuring, impermanence, peace, no self. It brings happiness to those who hear it, and it reaches the ears of all the living beings in that world system. So we'll be having more of this later on, but it gives you a flavour, I think. So there is this vastness of perspective, you know, yojanas, of perspective. And there's also a great sense of beauty, it's creating a sense of a land, a place which is just beautiful, and that beauty and the sounds within that land all communicate the Dharma, and that's the quality of Amitabha's Pure Land, that everything is whispering the Dharma. And in the Mahayana Sutras, you find what are called Buddha lands, which is the sphere of influence of a Buddha. And you have lands with no Buddhas, very dark places apparently. And you have impure Buddha lands and pure Buddha lands. So an impure Buddha land is a world system, a world with a Buddha, but it's difficult to practice the Dharma because there are influences which take us away from the Dharma. So there's influences of hatred, violence, fear, greed, avarice, jealousy, pride, ignorance, confusion. Yeah. And this is our world where we have these influences. Yeah? So we live in an impure Buddha land. But there's also love, generosity, compassion, selflessness in an impure Buddha land. There is the possibility of hearing and practicing the Dharma in an impure Buddha land. And then you have pure Buddha lands like Sukhavati, which are, as described, beautiful places where negative thoughts don't arise. Yeah? There are places of peace and happiness. Yeah? So Sukhavati is the realm of happiness, the realm of bliss. And as we heard, everything there conduces to the Dharma, everything there teaches the Dharma, the birds, the wind, the rivers. Yeah, everything is a Dharma teaching in Sukhavati. So, if you're inspired by the notion of pure lands, then your practice can be seen as purifying the Buddha land you're in. Yeah, so you move from an impure Buddha land to a purer Buddha land. Yeah, there's a process of purification. Yeah. Now, in one of the Sukhavati Sutras, Sukhavati is situated world system upon world system off to the west. So it's put as a very long, long way away indeed. Yeah. And sometimes it can feel like that in our impure Buddha land. But I don't think that's quite the whole story. So I want to tell the story of Vaidehi, who's the heroine, really, of the Third Sukhavati Sutra. And Vaidehi is the wife of Bimbisara, who's the king of one of the regions that the Buddha teaches in, and Bimbisara is a follower of the Buddha. And Bimbisara and Vaidehi have a son, Ajatasattu, and the Buddha has a cousin called Devadatta. So these are the protagonists of this story. Yeah. So Devadatta is an ambitious monk. Yeah. And he fancies a bit more influence and a bit more sway within the Buddha's community, within the Sangha. So he thinks, well, the Buddha's getting on a bit, you know. It's about time he passed things on. So apparently at a very large gathering, he says to the Buddha, look, you're getting on a bit. And I'm ready, you know, I'm ready for this. I'm ready to take things on, yeah. I want to be chairman of the Sangha. And the Buddha says, no, no way, yeah. Yeah, you're much too ambitious, yeah. You're not the right man, Yeah. Devadatta is a bit, well, he's very put out. Yeah. In fact, he's so put out that he hatches a plot to get rid of the Buddha. And Devadatta has a friendship with Ajatasattu, the king's son, and they get together. And apparently, Devadatta, in his own right, is quite an impressive sort of character, yeah, with some magical powers. Yeah, so he has impressed Ajatasattu. So he says to Ajatasattu, "Look, we've got to get rid of these old has-beens. Yeah? So why don't you get, you know, why don't you get rid of your dad and you become king, and I'll get rid of the Buddha. Yeah, so we'll have spiritual and temporal power. We'll be in charge. Yeah, we'll kind of rule this land politically, economically, and spiritually. You know, so that was the plan. Yeah, so Devadatta tried to get rid of the Buddha. So he hired first of all a band of mercenaries. And he sent them off to go and murder the Buddha. But apparently what happened is that when, I don't know if they went one by one, whether they were like samurai. Yeah. But anyway, when they went to the Buddha talked to them, taught them the Dharma, and they became his disciples. Yeah. So that plan was foiled. Yeah, the mercenaries became disciples of the Buddha. So next, he noticed that the Buddha went walking below a big hill. So he got a big boulder, and it's a little bit like Wile E. Coyote, really. He gets this big boulder on top of the hill, and then he pushes the boulder down as the Buddha is appearing. But a bit like Wile E. Coyote, it doesn't really work out. Yeah, the boulder smashes. Up before it reaches the Buddha, and there's just a tiny fragment creates a little cut on the Buddha's leg. So undeterred, he next gets a kind of mad elephant, yeah, and kind of waits for the Buddha to appear, and then he lets the elephant loose. So the elephant comes charging up towards the Buddha, apparently. And then the elephant stops because he feels the waves of loving kindness and compassion that are coming from the Buddha. And the elephant just becomes calm. So that plot is also foiled. So Devadatta hasn't gotten very far. So Ajatasattu tries to murder his dad, but the people won't have it, or his close advisors won't have it. So he puts him in prison, yeah. And the plan is then just to starve him, yeah, so he won't feed him. So Bimbisara is in prison. Vaidehi, his wife, then kind of sneaks in and feeds him. So he keeps, she keeps Bimbisara alive. Yeah. And meanwhile, apparently the Buddha is appearing magically in Bimbisara's cell and teaching. Yeah. So after 3 weeks, Ajatasattu noticed that his plan isn't working and that the king seems really well and surprisingly well fed, and he's looking quite happy as well. So he finds out that by day he has been going and feeding Bimbisara, giving him food. So he goes into a rage, and he pulls out his sword, and he's about to kill Vaidehi, his mother. But his ministers intervene and say, "Look, in history, you know, killing your father to become king is not unknown, but killing your mother is just not on." So they draw their swords. And the Jatasattu is, he kind of backs down, and but he throws Vaidehi into prison as well. So she's down in the deepest, darkest dungeon. Yeah, and she's unable to help Bimbisara, who now will get no food, so he will die. Yeah. And she's beside herself with grief. And she, in a cell, she calls out to the Buddha in her grief and despair. And she calls out to the Buddha and his disciple, two disciples. And they come to Vaidehi, and appear in her cell. And she says, how is it that I've been born where such things can happen in a world where such horrible things can happen? Yeah. That my own son can do this. Yeah. I no longer want to live in a world such as this. Yeah. Show me a world where none of this can happen. Yeah. So, abbreviating slightly, the Buddha then shows her Sukhavati, shows her a pure land, a realm beyond suffering. Yeah. And he then teaches Vaidehi how to move towards that world, how to visualize that world, how to take a place in that world. And the rest of the sutra is these instructions of how she can do this. So before he kind of shows her the visualization practices of how to inhabit the pure land, he gives some necessary preliminaries. So I'm just going to go through these because they're quite familiar. Yeah. So the first practice is going for refuge to the three jewels that he teaches Vaidehi. And I presume Vaidehi, as a lay follower of the Buddha, already is doing this. But he talks about holding fast to the three refuges. Yeah. So there is the sense here that in an impure Buddha land, there are lots of forces which pull you away from going for refuge, such as Vaidehi is experiencing in her despair. Yeah. So holding fast to the three jewels, when the going gets really tough, you hold fast to the three jewels. The image that came to mind is of being in on an island with a raging torrent, and you're holding fast to the island. And the forces of samsara are trying to carry you away. So holding fast to the three refuges, she is then taught to observe the precepts. So these are the precepts that we're all familiar with. And she's taught not just to observe these precepts to be good, or in traditional terms, to gain merit, but to observe the precepts in order to set up the conditions for awakening. So ethics is followed by meditation, is followed by wisdom. Wisdom is part of the path to awakening. Yeah. And then the Buddha advises her to cultivate a mind set on awakening. This is cultivating the bodhicitta. Yeah. So this is, I don't know if it's quite right to say this, but it just came to mind. This is one of the signature teachings of the Mahayana, is the bodhicitta. Is cultivate a mind set on awakening. And just what came to mind with this, I mean, this is a teaching we're all familiar with, one that we embrace within Sri Ratna. But it's not just about us, spiritual practice. And it's something I find it useful to remind myself, my practice is not just about me. Yeah, it's not just about my meditation, not just about my insight. Yeah, it's about others. Yeah, as well as myself. Yeah? And this is the bodhicitta. Yeah? And next, she's advised to cultivate a deep faith in cause and effect, to reflect on karma. What came to mind when I was thinking about this? I should say that, because I've been using this as a preparatory text, the Ratnaguna's excellent book on great faith, great wisdom, which is the introduction to the Saccavati Sutras. So I'm going to read a little bit that he quotes from in here. Yeah, let's have it. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to become ill. There is no way to escape illness. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me, and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. I am the owner of my own actions. I am born of my actions. I am related to my actions. I am supported by my actions. Any thoughts, words or deeds I do, good or evil, those I will inherit. So, those of you who have been to Dhanakosha will be aware that our longest standing resident died, Eddie the Cat, died about 3 weeks ago. And we had this kind of little ceremony for Eddie. And Ben recited verses very similar to these. And I was really surprised how powerful it was. I mean, the first four verses are accepting the reality of our situation. That we grow old, we get sick, and we die. And I guess it's been my experience that sometimes I can read out those words and they'll have had an effect, but they had much more effect in that context, sitting in the shrine room with Eddie lying there dead. And it kind of brings home, when you have that sort of reflection, that this is what happens, and it hits you here, hits you in the guts. It's the reality of your situation, of our situation. And the first verse is a reflection in cause and effect. How the reality that we experience turns out is up to us. And we are the heirs to our actions. We are the heirs to our speech. We are the heirs to our thoughts. Everything that we do, how we act, what we say, what we think about, what we obsess about in our minds has an effect on the reality of the world that we inhabit. We create our worlds. Various difficult things can happen to us, but we create our own worlds through our responses. I'll come back to that point. Fifthly, the Buddha suggests that by day he read and recite the Mahayana Sutras. Yeah. So we're going to be doing that. Well, I'm not going to be reading, Ben's going to be reading them, and I'm going to be reading them. But we can take in the Mahayana Sutras. And when you're listening to the Mahayana Sutras, it's good not to think about them too much. Yeah, not try and work them out. So how high is 12 yojanas? What does that look like? Yeah, it's just big. Yeah. Yeah. So we don't try and think about them too much. Yeah, we just open and let our imagination respond. Yeah. And if part of us is going, that's a lot of rubbish, just allow that voice to be there. Yeah, just be there with whatever your responses are. Yeah. The sixth thing that the Buddha recommends to Vaidehi is that she encourage people in their practice. Seemed quite a strange thing to recommend to someone who was locked up in a prison cell. But nevertheless, this is what he recommended to Vaidehi, to encourage people in their practice. And this hit home to me, this one, really, when I was thinking about this. I think what hit home was, I don't do this very often. That was one thing that occurred to me. Yeah. Having said that, I do it when I'm working, which is leading retreats. Yeah. Then I encourage people then. But when I'm off duty, I noticed that I didn't do it that much. Yeah. I didn't encourage people in their practice as much as I could do. It's not that I don't do it at all, but I didn't do it that much. And when I reflected about it, I kind of had this reflection as well. I wish people encouraged me a bit more in my practice. Yeah, I kind of thought it'd be a nice thing if people did that. Yeah. Because like many people, and one thing I observe it in myself, and I observe it a lot when I'm involved in retreats at Dana Kosha, perhaps the biggest thing that holds people back is doubt. Yeah? And this is not just people new to practice. You find doubt at all levels of practice. People doubt themselves, yeah. They doubt that they can develop, yeah. They doubt that they can grow, yeah. They doubt in all sorts of ways. And it's such a, can be such a crippling thing, doubt. It can really hold me back, and it can hold other people back. Yeah. I can't do that. Yeah. That's what I thought about this weekend. I can't do that. What do I know about the Pure Land? Yeah. And it's a voice which just arises, you know, it's the voice of self. Yeah. One way we create a restrictive self, a safe self in a way, is doubt. Yeah. We'll come on to this tomorrow, but for those who experience doubt, but who are nevertheless have a heart aspiration to be born in the Pure Land of Amitabha, are born in closed lotuses. Yeah, and the closed lotus is doubt. Yeah, it's what stops them seeing their spiritual potential or experiencing their spiritual potential. Yeah, so they sat there in a lotus. Yeah, and in time the lotus starts to open. Yeah, as they unfold and develop. Because the teachings of Saccavati still get through the closed lotus. You can still see the rivers singing impermanence, non-self, metta, kindness, compassion. It gets through. Yeah. And that's why I think it's great to encourage people. Yeah, because people often need a word of, yeah, you can do it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So why not make a practice of encouraging each other? Yeah. I mean, my mind temperamentally is quite critical, yeah, and I tend to go to the critical at times. And that is a useful faculty, but sometimes I have to watch some more unhelpful samskaras come in into that. Yeah. Whereas encouragement is generally positive, and helps people open. And if there's a mutual encouragement going on in a sangha, yeah, and it goes along with rejoicing, yeah, rejoicing in people's qualities, people blossom when they're rejoiced in and when they're encouraged. They get embarrassed, but they also soften and open. And we just naturally, through rejoicing, encouraging, we just naturally create sangha, yeah, spiritual community. Just happens when we do this. And when we do something mutually, like rejoicing, encouraging, in a way just practicing together, we create something which is bigger than us. Yeah? We tune into something bigger than us. And this is part of what Sakavati is getting at, and what Mahayana is getting at with this infinite perspective. There is an experience we can have which is bigger than us. On retreats, I do a lot of introductory retreats, Dana Kosha, and a lot of people are new. They've just walked off the street, really, into a week's retreat. And so they're a group of strangers not really knowing what they've come to and what it's all about. Yeah? But they've come because of, you know, they're interested, yeah, or drawn to it for some reason. And it's amazing how quickly a sense of community develops. Yeah. Me and Pasadani were involved in a retreat leaders session at Dana Kosha, and we were trying to describe what happens on retreats. And one thing we came up with is retreats are where magic happens. Yeah. And there is something magical happens. Yeah. And I would say 99% of retreats. I've been in one or two where it hasn't happened, but they were a long time ago. And it's kind of symbolized often by when you introduce a mantra and people really don't know a lot about what they're chanting. Yeah, you mean you talk a bit about it and you introduce it, but they don't really know what it is. And you introduce a mantra, and then you get this shift in atmosphere, yeah, and you sense something bigger has emerged, yeah, and there's a sense that you're participating in something bigger, and I can feel that in the room, and other people can feel it as well. So when you talk to people the next day, they talk about it. This, you know, it was really magical, you know, doing that chanting. And this is really what Sangharakshita calls the third order of consciousness. Yeah, I guess you're familiar with this idea. The collective consciousness that the Sangha develops when we share, yeah, when there's a sense of mutuality. Yeah. So the first order is the group, where individuality is lost. Yeah. What came to mind when I was writing this was my very first time of going to a football match, which was when an ordinary member used to be on the centre team with me back then, Sava Jyoti, took me to see Partick Thistle play Celtic. I've never been to a football match before, but that was a really strong experience of group consciousness. This baying animal, which was huge energy, but you could see people really weren't really aware of themselves within this great baying mob. It was quite awe-inspiring and terrifying. So that's the first order. You're probably all familiar with this teaching. That's the group consciousness. And then there's the individual, second order of consciousness, which is the individual. So it's a sense of ourselves, but it's a sense of isolated selfhood, a self being separate, which for many people is a sense of suffering when they feel isolated. But the third order of consciousness is a sense of being connected with others. It's the experience of Sangha. It's the mutuality. Probably what you've been experiencing here all this week. There's this sense of being part of something bigger. So the sense of being intimately connected with the vastness of the universe in terms of both space and time. Well, that's where it's going. That's where it's going. And, sometimes at the end of pujas, you get that sense, and that when you say the transference of merit and self-surrender, that's what it's getting at, a sense of you're actually participating in something which is vast. Huge, massive, many, many, hundreds of yojanas. And it's not only through the Sangha that we can get a glimpse of this bigger reality. It can occur to us at any time. At Dhanakosha, one of our signature retreats is hill walking retreats. And this is something we try and get across to people through connection with nature. When your awareness takes in nature, it's connecting with something bigger. There's a self-transcending element to its potential in our connection with the natural world. And in those retreats, I read this little reading, so I'm going to... I don't think anyone here has done a hill walking retreat. So it'll be probably new to most of you. A long time ago. So this is something I read out, which I use as a kind of a way of connecting a bit with the natural world. So this is from a mystic who lived in Wolverhampton at the turn of the century, called Evelyn Underhill. So this is what she's got to say. Look for a little time in a special and undivided manner at some simple external thing. This object of our contemplation may be almost anything we please, a picture, a statue, a tree, a distant hillside, a growing plant, running water, little living things. Look then at this thing which you have chosen. Clearly yet tranquilly, let go of the messages which countless other aspects of the world are sending, and so concentrate your whole attention on this one act of loving sight that all other objects are excluded from the conscious field. Do not think, but as it were, pour out your personality towards it. Let your soul be in your eyes. Almost at once, this new method of perception will reveal unsuspected qualities in the external world. First, you will perceive about you a strange and deepening quietness, a slowing down of our feverish mental time. Next, you will become aware of a heightened significance, an intensified existence in the thing at which you look. As you, with all your consciousness, lean out towards it, an answering current will meet yours. It seems as though the barrier between its life and your own, between subject and object, had melted away. You emerge with it in an act of true communion, and you know the secret of its being deeply and unforgettably. So that's probably describing something that we've all done. Yeah. You can always tell when there's a meditation retreat on at Dhyana Kosha, because you see people doing this sort of thing. You see them staring at a rock beside the loch for 10, 15, 20 minutes, totally lost. Or the standing, staring at the top of a fence post. Yeah. about 15 minutes. Yeah. Yeah. You kind of wonder what the locals make of all this. This is what's going on. Yeah, they're getting totally absorbed in an act of loving sight. Yeah, so they're feeling this sense of communion. And I mean, when we talk about the boundaries of subject-object merging, we immediately go into, wow, that sounds like something really big. Yeah. But actually, it's something that happens when you really get involved in something. Yeah? You sense the kind of boundary between you and what you're absorbed in. You know, it's no longer so hard and fast as you and it. Yeah? Or when it's with another person, when you're communicating, it's no longer a sense of you and them as two separate, discrete individuals. There's a more of a merging going on, and the boundaries, the subject-object boundaries, shimmer. And like a bit like a mirage. Yeah. So when we're in the state, we're just opening then to something bigger. Yeah, we feel connected. Yeah, with something bigger. Yeah. And when you're in this state, you tend to find that you're not so caught up in your stuff. Yeah, I don't know if you have this experience on retreat, but the first few days you're caught up in your stuff, all the things you're worried about. You're preoccupied about things going on in your life, in your work. It's just going round and round. And you're just caught up in it. But that starts to settle. And as it starts to settle, your mind just naturally stills. And you get these kind of samatha-type communion experiences with other people and with the world around you. Things drop away. And you're just a bit more open and receptive, and you do this thing of looking at things, you know, really taking them in. And when you're looking at them, they become more vivid, more alive. People do this, but also flowers just seem to glow. Yeah, you know, there's a vividness and vibrancy to your experience. And when I'm kind of in this space, I experience what I can best describe as, well, I could describe it as aliveness, a sense of just really being in my experience. Well, the best word I've found is a sense of presence. Yeah. It seems to describe it quite well. So there's a definite sense of the presence of my own being. You know, I just feel myself, you know, I feel the energy of my being. Yeah. It's all fizzing and bubbling, and yeah, it's all going on. Yeah. Thoughts are coming and going, feelings are coming and going, but also there's a sense of openness, yeah, an appreciation of the world around us, and that has a sense of presence to it. Yeah. When you're in this space, the loch at Dhyana Kosha has a presence. Yeah. Your favourite tree will have a presence. Yeah. The land has a presence, and it's somehow merged with your presence. Yeah. It's hard to know where one begins and the other ends. Yeah. It really is just a sense of presence, and you feel this living connection. Yeah. So I think you can see the story of Vaidehi as a metaphor for experience. The cell that she's in is the suffering and the sense of imprisonment that we can create through our habitual tendencies of greed, hatred and ignorance, craving, aversion and unawareness, the mind forged manacles of rigid self-view of us against the world, jealously guarding what is ours, including our own practice, and pushing away whatever we don't want, whatever threatens. Yeah. So we create this isolated self. Yeah. And the Pure Land that Vaidehi starts to have a glimpse of and starts to inhabit, that she's introduced to through the meditations, the visualization that the Buddha gives her, the Pure Land is a realm beyond self. It's beyond ego clinging. It's a realm of self-transcendence. It's a realm of beauty and of light. It's the realm of the Dharma. And everything in Sukhavati, in the Pure Land, teaches the Dharma, the rivers, trees and birds. As we heard, sing songs of impermanence, emptiness, non-self. Now, as I said, it can all sound very far away, but actually it isn't. Yeah. As Hak Kuen says in his Song of Meditation, this very body, the Buddha, this very place, the Lotus Paradise. So Lotus Paradise is Sukhavati, this very place, the Lotus Paradise. So we can experience self-transcendence here, yeah, just in being a Sangha. This is where we can experience self-transcendence. Or if, like me, you spend a lot of time in nature, you can experience it there. Yeah. If it has to be flat, well, it has to be flat. But, you know, if it's got mountains, so much the better. And we can experience beauty, yeah, in the world we appreciate, in the way we appreciate the world, yeah, looking at each other, yeah, with appreciative awareness. Yeah. We are all beautiful. Yeah. It's almost like a kind of hippie-ish cliche to say that, isn't it? That we're all beautiful. But when you have this appreciative awareness, you really start to notice the beauty in people. Yeah. And you notice this when you do the Metta Bhavana. People seem more beautiful. Yeah. When you're on retreat, people just seem more beautiful. Yeah. So again, this is the Pure Land, accessing the Pure Land. And can we see everything around us as teaching the Dharma? Yeah. The buses and the taxis that are trundling past here, yeah. In what way are they teaching the Dharma? Well, they're certainly impermanent. They come and go. Yeah. We can see them in that way. Yeah. But seeing everything as teaching the Dharma, I think one way of approaching this is just seeing that all of our life is practice. Yeah? It's not just about the meditation that we do in the morning or that we do when we meditate with others. Yeah. Our whole life is an opportunity. Yeah. I was just thinking about this in the last couple of days. Yeah. I drive quite a lot, and there's endless opportunities for patience when you're driving. Yeah. And non-reactivity. What a great practice in not reacting. Yeah. Because, of course, when you're driving, things happen very quickly. Someone pulls in front of you or does something that they shouldn't do. Yeah, and you react. Yeah, it's a great practice just to let that reaction go. Yeah, and practice patience. Yeah. I was doing reception with Ben yesterday at Dhanakosha, you know, for when people arrive. And I was aware that it was tempting when I was doing a retreat reception to say, oh, room one, it's at the top of the stairs up there. I thought, no, I can go and take them to room one. Just do something a little more, yeah? make their experience a little better in terms of arriving by talking to them, taking them to the room, yeah, just doing something a little more, yeah. It's a practice, yeah, and there's all these opportunities for practice all the time. Yeah. There's a couple of lines from Wordsworth I really like, and I think this is about really the actually a lot of practice for me is not about the big experiences, but it's about the little things. So what makes the best portion of a good man's life? It's his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Yeah. Little, nameless, and not a big deal. Yeah, you don't make a big thing about it. And the little, yeah. But many a mickle makes a muckle. Yeah, yeah. Lots of little things have a big effect, and have a big effect on us, and a big effect on each other. And when we do lots of little things, we are creating the world we live in. Yeah? And that's always our responsibility. We create the world we live in. Yeah? It's entirely up to us, the world we live in. And sure, there's difficult circumstances. Yeah, sometimes our life is difficult and we struggle because of that. But even so, we create our response to that, and we will recreate the world that we live in. A prison or a pure land. Yeah. We create the world we live in. I remember being with a friend in Kathmandu. And when you're in Kathmandu, one of the things you have to contend with is people coming up trying to sell you stuff, get you to do something. Yeah. And it can get a bit in your face, yeah, this. Yeah. And my friend was getting really upset by this, yeah. So wasn't he used to it, yeah. And he got a bit angry with people, and it came out in his response. And they'd get a bit kind of, yeah, a bit like that back. And I could see that he was creating a world which was actually a world of suffering, yeah. He was at odds with the world around him, the world that was presenting to him, he was in conflict. Yeah? And I remember saying to him, just watch what I do. Yeah. So I'd been in Nepal quite a few times, and I love being in Kathmandu. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of difficult things about life there. But instead of getting angry when someone comes up to you and tries to sell you something, my practice is to engage with them, yeah, engage with a human being. And Nepalese people are great, yeah, because when you engage with them, they immediately kind of, they forget about what they're trying to sell you, and they'll just talk to you, yeah, and you meet the human being, not someone who's trying to get something out of you, yeah. And that's the thing, once you get into this as someone trying to get something out of me, you get into an isolated world of suffering. Yeah? So you can turn this around in seconds just by the way you respond to it. Yeah? And the walk down the street can be a pure land or it can be hellish, yeah? Depending on how you respond to the people that you meet. Sauchie Hall Street isn't so bad in this respect. but you get the point, yeah. We create the world we live in. Yeah. So let's have a little break. 10 minutes. Then we'll come back in and we'll chant. The mantra of Amitabha, and we'll do a short sitting, then we'll have lunch. Yeah.
Gonna find out what happened to the king.
What happened to the king? Unfortunately, he died. But he became a non-returner. Or was it a once-returner? See, a once-returner or a non-returner? He was either a once returner or a non returner, so it didn't matter that he died. So he's only going to come back once more, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas the outlook for a Jatisatu wasn't that pleasant, really.
No.